Cecilia, he said. It was only a dream, a night terror. Naked, he stood and lit a lamp using hot embers from the hearth. Slowly, slowly, the images from her nightmare faded into reality. She was naked, too, her stomach bulging. She settled her hands on her round skin, rubbing up and down. She was still pregnant. Only a dream, not real. Only a dream, not real. She repeated it several times in her head, until her heart stopped pounding. "Can I touch you?" Gil said. His voice was still calm. She loved him for it.
"Yes," she said.
He slid across the bed and took her in his arms, his skin a rush of cool next to the heat inside her. "Was it the same dream?" he asked.
"Yes. Our boy was killed."
Like always, she didn't tell him he was sin-marked, nor that it was Gil who'd killed him. His lips pressed against her forehead, lingering as he spoke against her skin.
"Our child is healthy and strong."
He placed a hand on her belly. Right on time, the baby kicked. The prince laughed. "See? Nothing to fear."
"I hope we have a girl," Cecilia said.
"Would that make you happy?"
"Oh, Roth." "Yes."
"Then I hope we have a girl, too."
Alas, it was not meant to be.
"Are you disappointed it's not a girl?" Gil asked, letting the babe's tiny hand grip his thumb.
Cecilia smiled. Though she was exhausted and sore from the ordeal of childbirth, she'd never been happier. Her nightmare had not come true. For one, her husband wasn't even there for the birth, and afterwards he'd arrived with a knitted crown, not a knife, which he placed atop their son's head. The child, Roan Loren, they'd named him, slept in her arms, swaddled in the softest linen blanket they could find in all of Night's End. Cecilia was happy because his chest was pale and smooth, not pulsing with light like in her recurring dream.
"No," she said. "He is our child, and he is perfect."
Gil moved his hand from the babe to her cheek, cupping her chin.
"My heart is torn in two," he said. "You have half, Roan the other."
Warmth spread from her chin throughout her body. It was the warmth of gratitude. Roth had blessed her in so many ways. This man would never hurt her son. He would make a great father, teaching the boy the mysterious ways of Roth and the true path to the seventh heaven. Roan would be loved, and one day he would be the king of the West. The door opened without a knock. One of the Furia stepped inside the room bearing a torch, her pale skin dancing with orange and red streaks of light. Cecilia had the strange impression that her crimson dress was soaked in blood. She shivered.
"What is this woman doing here?"
"Gil," Cecilia said. "This will only take a moment, my love. We have to set a good example for the realm."
A tremor rolled through her bones.
"What example?"
"That we are not above Roth's law. It's no more than a ritual. Pass the torch over the prince. Declare him holy and unmarked."
Images from her nightmare flashed through her mind, but she shook them away. They weren't real. Gil looked at her with love, not violence. Though he did have an ornately forged knife in a hip scabbard, it was purely ornamental. The prince's dagger, it was called. The woman approached, raising the torch. Cecilia held her breath as the orange light passed over Roan's tiny face. The babe continued sleeping, oblivious to the ritual being performed.
"Remove the wrapping," the woman said,
her tone devoid of emotion. Gil started to peel back the cloth, but Cecilia stopped him.
"Let me,"
she said. He nodded. First, she slipped the blanket away from his shoulders, then one arm and his two legs. A triangle of cloth remained draped across one arm and his chest, which rose and fell with each slumbering breath. Cecilia paused only a fraction of a second before uncovering the rest. She breathed out sharply, when his skin remained pale and smooth.
unmarked. Thank Roth. Thank the heathen gods of the south. Thank the sun and the stars and the...
Red lines began to form, curving along the child's skin, creating a strange pattern that seemed to make no sense until the lines came together, blazing forth with a bright light in the shape of a three-leafed plant.
"Oh, Roth,"
Gil said, desperation in his voice.
"Why?"
Cecilia's eyes flooded with tears, but she blinked them away so she could recover her sleeping babe. She held him to herself protectively.
"Let this be another nightmare."
She pinched herself.
"Wake up! Wake up! Roth, damn it!"
She'd never cursed before, not even in her own mind, and certainly not against her god. But now she cursed him with all her fury. The Furia didn't say anything, just retracted the torch and dunked it in a nearby washbasin. The flames sizzled and hissed as they died. When she turned back to face them, her eyes seemed to glitter darkly. "The boy is cursed. But you have a choice." Cecilia blinked.
"What choice?"
She'd never known the holy warriors to be merciful, but maybe they had to be when it came to the monarchy. Maybe there was a way out.
"Who will send the boy back to the underworld from whence he came? One of you or me?"
"No!"
Cecilia screamed.
"You can't have him! He's mine!"
Because of the commotion, Roan awoke, unleashing a high-pitched wail that she barely heard. Still holding her son, Cecilia swung to her feet, her teeth bared, daring the Furia to try to take her child.
"I will die before you touch him."
The red-cloaked woman didn't react, simply looked at the prince.
"The choice is yours," she said.
Incredulous, Cecilia's eyes darted from her husband to the Furia and back again.
"Gil,"
she said.
"Please."
Tears trickled from her eyes, trembling down her skin. Roan continued to scream, his tiny mouth searching for her breast.
"I'm sorry,"
the prince said. "The law is the law. There is nothing I can do." Cecilia bit her lip so hard she broke the skin. The warmth of blood joined her tears.
This was the man she married,
devoted to Roth and his laws, unerring in his obedience, holy to a fault. The man she loved. The man she now hated.
"I'll do it,"
he told the Furia, who only nodded. He drew his knife. All fight went out of Cecilia, who felt numb, broken. She crumpled to the floor, cradling Roan as he shrieked. He screamed so loud he was having trouble breathing, his wails interrupted by choking sobs. And then his mouth found her breast and he quieted, suckling hungrily. Gil crouched beside her, and there was only sorrow in his eyes.
"I only wanted for you to be happy," he said.
His words were truth. His words were a lie.
"Then if you kill my son, your son, kill me too,"
she spat. She tossed back her head and exposed her neck. She could feel the blood pumping through her veins. Blood she no longer wanted, not if the cost was her child. Her husband stared at her, horrified, indecision flickering across his face.
I can't. I don't know.
"You have a choice," the Furia repeated. "Give him to me. Leave in peace. I will do Roth's will."
Cecilia could see the moment the prince made his decision, a strange light entering his eyes. An almost blank look, like he himself couldn't believe what he was about to do. He stood, his grip tightening on the knife's handle. And, just like in her nightmare, he raised the blade over his head and spun, whipping his hand around so fast there was no time for the Furia to react, the dagger entering her chest, her heart. Her mouth gaped open, blood already bubbling up from her throat. Her eyes widened, and then she collapsed.
"Gil?"
Cecilia said, shocked by the turn of events.
"Gil?"
Roan stopped eating, falling back to sleep. Prince Gil Loren, future King of the West, turned to face her. "Go," he said. "Take the child back to our bedchamber. I will take care of everything." In that moment, she knew she'd love her husband until the day she died. She also knew she'd do anything to protect him and their son. 2 years later.
"Mama,"
little Roan said, reaching for the baby girl who was on Cecilia's breast. Her latch was strong, and she was very hungry. "Hungry and strong and healthy," she mused. "Just like Roan."
"Baby,"
Cecilia corrected, helping her son to be more gentle.
"Babu,"
Roan tried.
"Your baby sister,"
Cecilia said.
"Rhea."
A smile lit up Roan's face.
Ri,
he said. "I guess she has her nickname," Gil said, crossing the large bedchamber. He swooped in and picked up Roan, twirling him around as he giggled. As Cecilia watched her husband play with their son, she marveled at how many faces he was able to wear. Childlike father, stern and pious king, iron-fisted ruler. He was a rare kind of man, as multifaceted as the rarest of gemstones. The last year had been a mixture of emotions, from deep sadness upon the death of King Ennis Loren, to beaming pride at Gil's coronation, to unfettered happiness when their daughter, Rhea, was born. Sometimes Cecilia could only shake her head in disbelief at all that had happened in a mere 4 seasons. And yet, behind each of those emotions was another, darker one. Fear. Though Gil had promised her they would never be found out, that he'd covered his tracks well, that Roan would grow up a prince of the West, the secret of his sin mark known only by them, Cecilia worried every day that the Furia would smash in their door and take their son away screaming. It was that suffocating fear that drove Cecilia to take every precaution against Roan's secret being found out. He was never permitted to remove his shirt in public, even during the day when the use of torchlight would be unlikely. When he did remove his shirt, only she and Gil were present. Numerous times she'd been forced to chase off keen chambermaids seeking to be helpful. Little did they know, Cecilia had saved their lives. Everything had changed in Cecilia's world, as if she'd been spun and flipped, only to have landed on her head. She could no longer think of those who were marked as demons with monstrous power. Her son was no demon. Roan was an angel. Her angel. Despite the fact that Cecilia had celebrated her 21st name day shortly after her coronation, she felt as if she'd aged a decade since those light-hearted days spent practicing her royal signature. And though the king did his best to hide it behind a smile and a laugh, she knew he had his own demons to deal with. Already, streaks of silver lined his golden hair. Crow's feet had penetrated the flesh on either side of his eyes, and purple, bruise-like circles marred the flesh over his high cheekbones. In short, he looked as old as Cecilia felt. While Rhea suckled and the queen watched her husband play with her son, she saw the future. Roan, at 4 years old, fast and mobile and not wanting to be shackled by cloth and stitching, shucking off his shirt and running rampant throughout the castle. Torchlight scattering across his skin. Light bursting forth from his sin mark for all the lords and ladies and servants to see. Or no, maybe not at 4, but at 14. Roan courting a girl, a beautiful maiden of the realm. Removing their clothes, exploring each other's skin under the light of a full moon. A torch is lit, and then, love? Gil said. Cecilia was dimly aware that her husband was shaking her shoulders, repeating the same question again and again. Rhea was crying, no longer suckling. Roan was toddling about the room, shouting, "Ri-ri, ri-ri," with unabashed glee.
I'm sorry, Cecilia said. I was lost in a daydream.
Gil frowned, and she could tell he didn't fully believe her, but he didn't push the issue. Instead, he said,
"You're tired. You should rest."
He gently pulled Rhea from her arms.
We'll talk later.
Yes, Cecilia thought. Later. After Roan is safe. Safe forever.
By chance or fate, or the will of Roth, Queen Cecilia Thorne Loren knew a man from the south. His name was Markin Swansea. He'd once been a refugee from Calip, where his people, the barbarians of the Dreadnoughts, were being persecuted by the Southron Empire. A young, orphaned boy of only 12, he'd fled to the west to avoid being enslaved in the Phoenician mines, or sold to the fighting pits of Zoon. Despite his grizzled grey skin and broad, flat forehead, he'd been taken in by a kindly, Roth-abiding family living in the western border town of Felix. Unable to bear children of their own, they clothed him and fed him and treated him like their own flesh, much to the disdain of their neighbours, many of whom believed all Southroners were barbarians. Eventually, when the violence along the border became too much for them, they travelled to Night's End, seeking a more peaceful life. Markin's adopted mother was a seamstress named Maud. His adopted father was a talented bootmaker named Jordan Vaughan. Though both his parents worked tirelessly, gold was hard to come by in the big western city. Markin was apprenticed to his father, and learned the art of bootmaking, improving year by year until his own abilities surpassed his master's, which made many westerners willing to ignore the unnatural hue of his skin and outlandish features. He opened his own shop, and his fame grew, until word reached a very powerful western house, Thorne. Upon seeing the quality of his workmanship for themselves, Grant and Gertrude Thorne immediately offered Markin Swansea a place in their employ. What an opportunity! Not only would he be able to make the finest boots in the Four Kingdoms, Markin could send half of his earnings home to his parents. Because of the quality of his boots and his even-tempered nature, Markin's relationship with the Thornes grew to one of trust and mutual respect. When they had a daughter, Cecilia, he loved her like his own kin, and looked out for her like a father or elder brother. And Cecilia loved him back. She trusted him with her life, and now with the life of her only son. "Take him south," she said, thrusting Roan into the man's arms. She told him everything. The boy's secret, what Gil had done to protect their family, the fear she felt each and every day. The words had poured out of her like waters long held back by a dam. He'd listened intently, his jaw growing stiffer and stiffer with each word. Now, as Markin, the man she'd grown up loving like a brother, held her child, she held her breath, hoping her trust had not been misplaced. He could easily turn them in and collect a reward. The king would be shamed, and they would both be punished severely by the Furia. But she was counting on the fact that Markin Swansea came from a land where those marks were not hated, not feared. A place where Roan would be able to grow up in relative safety. Markin slung Roan onto his shoulder and said,
"I will do this for you."
"Protect him with your life."
"I will."
"Do whatever it takes to keep his secrets."
"I will."
"Do not let him use the power of his mark. Not ever."
"I won't."
"Promise me."
"I promise you," Markin said.
Cecilia kissed her son for the last time and went to face her husband. 3 years later. For the last 3 years, the Lorenz had filled their lives with as many distractions as possible. Gil and Cecilia spent innumerable hours at court, ruling the realm. The Hundred Years' War had intensified as of late, and King Loren was constantly in strategy meetings with his war council. However, when the king and queen had time away from ruling and war, they spent those precious hours watching Rhea grow up into a beautiful and rambunctious little princess. Cecilia got pregnant again, and gave birth to twins, Bea and Leo. The king and queen made love every night, and though it didn't have the same excitement as it used to, it, like their many other activities, took their minds off the loss of their son, Roan. No one talked about the princeling's mysterious disappearance 3 years earlier, because no one wanted to upset the king and queen. It was as if Roan Loren never existed at all, which was precisely what Cecilia wanted.
She knew her husband had never truly forgiven her for sending the boy south, but she knew it was for the best. The West was no place for one bearing a sin mark. Though Cecilia strove every day to forget about her eldest son, his memory often sprang to mind unbidden. His toothless smile, his squeal of delight when she would kiss his belly, the peaceful nights nursing him, when all was quiet save for the wind brushing the branches and leaves of the alders in the royal gardens. She wondered every day whether Roan was alive, whether he was happy. As she'd requested, Markin never tried to contact her with information about her son. Now she was so desperate to hear from him, she wished she'd never made the request in the first place.
No,
she chided herself. It was far too dangerous. With the invention of streaming, a rapid method of communication that relied on the strange properties of the ink from an ink reed, namely that the ink, when dipped in water, would always return to the waters from which the original reed grew, there was always the possibility that the message could be received by the wrong person. And then what she did would be discovered. These were her thoughts as she nursed her twins and watched Rhea play with a rope doll made by her nursemaid. These were her thoughts when there was an unexpected knock at her bedchamber door. She unlatched Bee from her breast and set her in her bassinet beside her brother, who was already sleeping. Rhea looked up, but then went back to playing. Cecilia covered herself, crossed the room, and opened the door. A young man with a satchel slung from shoulder to hip across his chest stood before her. He was surrounded by guards and looked scared out of his wits.
"I'm sorry to disturb you, Your Highness," one of the guards said. "This messenger had strict instructions to deliver his scroll directly to you, and no others."
Strange, Cecilia thought, but she held out her hand and accepted the rolled sheet of parchment, which was tied with a black ribbon in the center. Almost no one used messengers anymore, as streaming was far easier and faster, not to mention cheaper. "Thank you," she told the messenger. "You have done well. Reward him with a gold coin before you escort him out," she added, speaking to one of the guards.
Thank you, Your Highness," the boy said.
They departed, and the queen closed the door. Bee had begun to cry, but she barely heard her. She stared at the scroll, and a sense of foreboding filled her. It was tinged with a leap of excitement in her chest.
This could be from Markin.
The moment the thought entered her mind, however, she wished it hadn't. Markin was not one to break promises, so he wouldn't send a message all the way from the south unless it was horrible news.
"Open it."
Now Leo was crying too, the baby's high-pitched voices joining together. Rhea tugged on her mother's dress.
"Make them stop, Mama," she said.
But Cecilia was too focused on the black ribbon, which was tied perfectly, like someone had spent hours working the silky material to get it just right. In the West, black was the color of death, of mourning.
"Roth, please give me strength," Cecilia prayed.
Bee cried. Leo cried. Rhea pulled harder on her dress.
"Mama!"
she complained. With delicate fingers, the queen tugged on the end of the bow, watching with held breath as it uncoiled. The dark ribbon spilled from her hands, landing atop Rhea's head. Slowly, slowly, Cecilia unrolled the parchment. With a gasp, she ripped the page into two pieces, rushed to the hearth, and thrust the message into the fire. Only after the scroll had blackened, shriveled, and turned to ash could she breathe again. But that didn't stop the words from echoing through her mind, burned into memory for the rest of her life. "We know what you did with Roan. We know he was sin-marked, and we can prove it." Cecilia didn't tell her husband about the message. She didn't tell anyone. Instead, she let the words eat her alive from the inside until they became a part of her, consuming her mind with fire, each word burning, burning, burning. They were at court the next day,
A petitioner was on his knees, begging for mercy, but Cecilia wasn't paying attention as the fiery words spilled through her mind.
I know what you did. Sin-marked. Prove it. It was impossible. She'd been cautious. She'd covered her tracks. She tried to remember back to the day she'd given Roan to Markin. Had anyone seen her? Or did someone find evidence of what Gil had done to the Furia, the woman who had discovered Roan's mark in the first place? No. This message was for her. Her husband wasn't the one being threatened, which meant he was still safe. But for how long? And what did this person want from her? Gold? She would pay whatever it took to keep her secret. Power. She would convince her husband to appoint this individual to any position he or she wanted. But something told her the message sender's motives were far more sinister. He or she wanted to destroy the Lorenz. So a rebel, then. Someone seeking to usurp the throne and replace the Lorenz with another house. There were many powerful houses in the West, most of which had long envied the Lorenz and Thorns. House Gallo, perhaps. They were a brutal family. Or House Charvone. Another dozen houses sprang to Cecilia's mind, but none of them seemed quite right. Any one of them could be behind this threat. Suddenly the throne beneath her felt more like a tomb than a place of honour. The king, unaware of the thoughts of his wife, finished with the petitioner and settled back in his own throne. Instead of the next petitioner, when the doors opened again there was a messenger, and in his hands was a tightly rolled scroll. Cecilia froze. It was tied with a black ribbon, perfectly formed into a bow. But wait. Another messenger appeared behind him, carrying a similar sheet of rolled parchment. It also had a black bow. A third messenger entered just behind him, then a fourth and a fifth. This is it, Cecilia thought. The end of everything we've worked for. The first messenger stood before her and handed her the message. The second provided his message to the king. Each of the three other couriers passed their scrolls to one of the three Furies, the leaders of the Furia, who often appeared at court in case their righteous counsel was required. With trembling hands, Cecilia untied and unfurled the scroll. It was a petition, claiming witnesses had come forth in the south. A man of Dreadnought origin had arrived in Citadel with a boy who was clearly not of his own blood. The boy had sun-drenched hair and bright blue eyes. The witnesses had spied on the boy and his guardian and had discovered something. The boy was marked. Several days later, the boy and his guardian vanished. One of the witnesses had been able to identify the dark-skinned man of Dreadnought heritage, Markin Swansea, a known friend to the Thorns, who had disappeared on the same day as Prince Roan more than 3 years earlier. Further, a Western witness, one of the castle servants, pledged to having seen Queen Cecilia Thorn Lorraine escort two-year-old Roan to Markin's residence the day before they both disappeared. The bottom of the message contained a litany of signatures from all the witnesses, as well as from several prominent houses that were behind the accusations. Cecilia tried to swallow but couldn't, her throat as dry as sun-heated stone. She glanced at her husband, whose face had gone pale. He didn't look angry or scared or even sad. He looked determined. She'd seen that look before, the moment he made the decision to kill the Furia and protect his son, Roan. She knew he would risk everything to protect her, to shield his family. In short, he would take the fall if he had to. And it would surely cost him the throne House Lauren had held for hundreds of years. She couldn't let him do that. She owed him everything, her love, her children, the life of her eldest son. Her life. The three had finished reading their scrolls as well, which surely said the same thing. The Furia would investigate the accusations. Perhaps only her guilt would be confirmed, but what if the king was found to be complicit? Even if he wasn't, she would be guilty of treason, and the only punishment available would be death. The king would be forced to sentence her to death.
but she knew he wouldn't. He would break his own laws to save her. And then there would be open rebellion against the crown, led by the Furia themselves. The realm would be entrenched in a civil war, and her entire family would suffer. They might even be killed. She made a choice, the only choice. She would protect her family, the way her family had protected her all these years. Before her husband could react, she reached across and snatched his royal dagger from his hip scabbard. He cried out, tried to grab for her, but she squirmed away, turning the blade back toward herself, gripping it firmly with both hands.
"I'm sorry,"
she mouthed, to him, to her children. And then she plunged the blade into her own chest. Bright lights. Not sunlight, but something else. Something otherworldly.
"Roth. Roth. Is that you? Is that the face of my God?"
The world rushed back to meet her, a blur of sound and colours and faces hovering over her. The three, their cold faces devoid of emotion, staring down with dark, judging eyes. Several guardsmen, their mouths open, full of shock at what she'd done. And him. King Gil Loren's brilliant azure eyes were wet, his lips quivering and bent. He was saying something, but she couldn't make it out amongst the carnage in her mind. And then his face was all she saw, his voice all she heard.
"I love you," he said. "I always loved you. I know,"
she tried to say, but all she had left was a gurgle. He kissed her cheek, then her forehead. Finally, he closed her eyes, and he kissed them, too. As the life drained out of her, Cecilia considered how her life had changed from those days when all she wanted was the power and prestige of being a queen. Now she would die happy, if only because her children were safe. And whatever heaven she ended up in, she would have no regrets. Postlude 3. Mark in Swansea. The Southern Kingdom. Calypso, circa 524. Red. So much red. As Mark in Swansea passed through the Calypsian marketplace, it seemed to be the only colour he could see. There were other colours, yes. Bright yellows and pastel pinks and blues, and ashy greys and browns. But those colours seemed dull, fading away into the background, leaving only red. Here, a long, silky red dress that would sweep the ground behind a woman's step. There, a desert fruit called himsu, with its crimson flesh as bright as a lit coal. Red had been her favourite colour, though most wouldn't have known it. Like all the other women of Night's End, Queen Cecilia Thorne Loren had worn white, the colour of purity, when in public. But in private, that's when she'd always taken his breath away. Leaving Cecilia in Night's End had been the hardest thing Mark in Swansea had ever had to do. And yet it was for the best. He'd loved her, a woman he could never have had, never have touched, not the way he wanted to. When she was a child, his love for her was brotherly, but as she grew into a woman flowered, everything changed. So when she had dragged him aside into her private quarters and asked him her desperate question, "Will you save my son?" What choice did he have but to agree? He'd taken the prince, Roan, the true heir to the Western throne, to Calypso, a place he'd fled from as a child. A place that had recently become friendly to dreadnoughters due to the Southern Civil War. That was 8 years ago, a lifetime. An eternity, when spent away from Cecilia. Worse, 5 years ago he'd received the most awful news of his life. Cecilia was dead, having taken her own life in public, shoving a knife through her own skin. And 5 long years later, he was still seeing red everywhere he went, her words eternally painted in blood on the edge of his vision. "Protect him with your life. Do whatever it takes to keep his secrets. Do not let him use the power of his mark. Not ever. Promise me."
"I promise,"
Markin thought now for the 1000th time, tossing provisions into his satchel, barely glancing at the merchant as he handed over the required number of silver dragons. The merchant, a balding, dark-skinned man with a tendency to overcharge, gave him a strange look and shook his head. Though the Calypsians in this part of the city were used to seeing his dreadnoughter features, grizzled grey skin and broad, flat forehead, they were never friendly to him, especially because he refused to haggle with them. And yet they took his money at the markets and paid top coin for the boots he made, which were considered the finest in the city. In the end, coin made up for all differences amongst people. Markin hustled to the next store, feeling anxious all of a sudden, and not just because of his thoughts of Cecilia. He left Roan home alone, something he was loath to do despite the boy having reached his 10th name day. The lad seemed responsible enough, but from experience, Markin knew that bad things happened every day.
Protect him. Keep his secrets.
He didn't yet have everything he'd come to the markets for, but he didn't care. Sweat ran down his back, beneath his thick, sun-protecting cloak. Too many people were blocking his way, their dark skin shining with noonday light. He stood taller and broader of shoulder than most of them, as did most who originated from the string of ancient islands known as the Dreadnoughts. Using a meaty fist like a battering ram, he pushed through the crowds, ignoring the hissed protests from those shoved aside like children.
"Why did I come to the markets at the busiest time of day?"
he chided himself, skirting a cart pulled by a three-legged guanic, its reptilian scales reflecting sunlight. It snapped at him, its long pink tongue flicking between sharp teeth, but he barely noticed, such was his focus on escaping the throng. More curses, more dark glances from the surrounding crowd. And then he was free, launching himself into a run, his strides long and thumping. Dreadnoughters weren't exactly known for their speed and agility, but Markin was determined to arrive back at his dwelling in as little time as possible. People stared at him as he pounded down the dusty streets, cutting a corner so sharply he scraped sandstone from a building with his thick shoulder. The whole time he ran, he told himself he was being a paranoid fool, until he emerged into the broad dust bowl that neighbored his residence and saw a scene that scared him more than anything, the fear of which would keep him up for countless nights after. He slammed to a stop, so shocked he couldn't move for several moments. Roan was in the yard with the other children, his sun-kissed skin glowing, actually resonating white light, vapors streaming off of him. The young boy was kneeling beside one of the neighborhood girls, a dark-skinned beauty who was known to regularly best the Calypsian boys in sport, despite being somewhat smaller. There was something wrong with her leg, which was bent the wrong way, the apparent result of an accident while playing. As Markin stood, dumbfounded, the white vapors streamed from Roan's chest into the girl's leg, and her bone snapped back into place with an audible crunch. She and another boy stared at Roan with a look of awe.
"No!
Protect him. Keep his secrets. Do not let him use his mark. Not ever."
Life flowed back into Markin's limbs, and he finally moved, hurrying toward the trio, scanning the rest of the field for witnesses. None of the other kids seemed to have noticed what had transpired, chasing the leather sack that was the subject of their game. Around the perimeter there were few adults, and none showed any interest in the game, immersed in quiet conversation, as was their way.
"Perhaps we got lucky," Markin thought.
Roan reached forward to touch the girl's face, perhaps to wipe her hair away from her eyes, but Markin was quicker, grabbing his arm and holding him back. The boy's eyes widened when he saw his guardian. He knew he was in trouble. For years, Markin had counseled the boy on the dangers of using his healing powers, both for him and for those he tried to help. In the end, the boy couldn't help himself, something Markin secretly respected, though he couldn't show it now, not if he was to keep his promise to Cecilia. Roan tried to utter an apology, but Markin had already hauled him to his feet and pushed him toward their dwelling, ordering the two Calypsian children to follow. So shocked were the children by the entire sequence of events that they didn't argue, trailing behind obediently. Inside, Markin dragged Roan up the stairs to his room on the second floor, locking him inside, ignoring his shouted protests. Down below, the girl found her tongue.
"My leg was broken. I felt it," she said.
"You were mistaken,"
Markin said. She shook her head.
"It was bent the wrong way,"
she said insistently.
"He did something. He was glowing."
The boy beside her was silent, but he nodded in agreement.
"Your fall wasn't as bad as you thought,"
Markin said. She started to protest again, but Markin strode toward her, his hands curling into fists. This near, he towered over her, his shadow covering both children in darkness. She closed her mouth but didn't retreat, while the boy took a step backward.
"You were mistaken,"
Markin said again. The girl chewed her lip, looking him up and down with narrowed eyes that were either fearless or disguised her fear well. She was a bold one, this girl.
"What's my mistake worth?"
she asked.
"Ah, the language of the Calypsians," Markin mused. "Negotiation."
The dark-skinned people seemed to live for it. Paying a copper dragon less for a bowl of mushki seemed a greater reward to them than the meal itself. Markin had never understood this mentality. In the dreadnoughts, the value of something was the value. Everyone paid the same. Prices changed, yes, but uniformly. There was no arguing the price set by a merchant. Here, in Calip, the price one haggler paid could be different from the next. Markin hated this, refusing to take part, which usually meant he overpaid by almost double in many cases. But now he had no choice but to bargain with this girl.
"One golden dragon," he said,
though the girl tried to hide it. Her eyes widened slightly, before narrowing once again.
"I've started too high,"
Markin realized. A foolish mistake by a novice negotiator.
"Six golden dragons,"
the girl counted, hands on hips. It was an astronomical price, one that could almost purchase a guanic. Markin laughed like she'd just said the most absurd thing he'd ever heard. And yet, if it came down to it, he would pay double that for her silence, triple even, all that he had.
"One golden and one silver," he said.
Now it was her turn to laugh, although he knew her stomach must have been doing backflips. There was no way this girl had ever even touched a golden dragon, much less owned one. To her credit, however, she covered her excitement like a professional. Her parents had trained her well.
"Three goldens, not a copper less."
"You are a shrewd haggler,"
Markin said, attempting to play to her childish bravado.
"Give me the dragons and prove it," she said.
The boy finally found his confidence, taking a half step forward.
"What about me?"
"You will share the price with your friend."
"No deal,"
the girl said. The boy nodded in agreement.
"Whatever we agree for me, you will pay him too."
Markin thought on it for a moment. The agreed price would remove a good deal of the coin he had saved over the last year, but there was nothing for it. He nodded.
"Agreed. But you will never speak of what you saw today. You will take your winnings to your family, and you will tell them to move to another city, as far away from Calypso as possible. You will tell them that if you don't move, you will have to give the dragons back. That is the deal."
"Three dragons each?"
the girl confirmed. She was absently rubbing her palms together, as if she could already feel the heat of the coins against her skin.
"I have her. Three golden dragons each."
"What if our parents won't leave the city?"
"Then I come for you all."
He rose to his full height, drawing a knife from his hip scabbard. It was a leather knife, used for cutting the raw materials used to make boots, not particularly dangerous, but they didn't know that. Violence was not in Markin's nature, but he forced as much venom into his voice as possible, shaping the threat one word at a time.
"I will kill you."
It was not what the girl had expected, her mouth falling open slightly. The boy was already halfway out the door, willing to abandon the dragons. The girl, however, was as tough as they came. She stuck out her hand.
"I will convince my family to leave Calypso forever,"
she gestured to the boy.
"He is my brother. We will both leave."
Markin moved to a chest in the corner, using a small key to unlock it. He counted out their dragons, letting each coin drop into his palm with a clink. Then he shoved them into the girl's hand and growled at her. All courage gone, she screamed and raced through the door, tight on the boy's heels. Markin's legs felt like rubber as he sank into a crouch. Too close. If more people had seen what Roan had done, there would have been no covering it up. Word would spread like wildfire. The Empress would come for the boy, eventually. From there, the news would reach all corners of the Four Kingdoms, including Night's End. And everyone would know the long-lost Prince of the West had been found in the South. And then the Western King's honour and righteousness would be questioned. The Loren line would fall after hundreds of years of rule.
"Cecilia," Markin whispered, "I won't fail you."
Markin pushed back to his feet, lighting a fire in the centre pit, feeding it with kindling and then larger logs. He wanted the blaze to be as hot as possible for what he needed to do. Next, he went to the cold chest and extracted the two lambs he'd been saving for a special occasion. He hated to waste the meat, but this was an emergency. He gently placed both small lambs into the fire. Smoke roiled around the meat, escaping through a long chute built into the roof. Soon the meat was charred, bubbling and melting away. The bones cracked, blackened around the edges. Slowly, slowly, the fire burned itself out. Markin watched it the entire time, his eyes stinging. Step by step, he climbed to the second floor. Before opening the door, he forced anger onto his face, when in reality all he felt was utter exhaustion. Roan pushed his long blonde locks away from his eyes when the door opened.
"This is what your disobedience has done," Markin said, snapping each word,
spitting them out like a bad taste. He needed it to be believable. He needed to scare the boy into never using his mark again. The boy sniffed. He could smell the burned meat now. He pushed past Markin and ran down the steps, skidding to a stop just before the fire pit, which was all ash and smoke now. And two sets of bones. Small bones. It broke Markin's heart when he heard the despair in the boy's voice.
"No!"
He backed away rapidly, too horrified to inspect the bones closer, something Markin had counted on. Roan's stomach heaved and he threw up, collapsing to the ground.
"You killed them," he breathed.
Markin wanted to comfort the lad, to tell him the truth, to show him he wasn't a murderer. But that would only encourage the boy to use his powers again, and then all would be lost. He needed to think the consequences of his actions were deadly.
"Death is but a change in existence, like rain turning to ice in the north, or evaporating to mist in the south."
"You're a monster."
The words were stabs in his chest.
"Let him think me a monster," he thought. "It will save him in the end. It is worth it."
He knelt next to Roan, pushing his lips close to the boy's ear.
"Maybe so. But I will do what I must to protect you. Using your power is dangerous for everyone. You are too important to risk."
As the boy wept, Markin scooped him up in his strong arms and carried him back upstairs. Not too gently, he rolled him onto his bed. Then he left, closing the door but not locking it. The boy wouldn't leave his room, not tonight. For a moment he stood outside the room, his hands shaking. His back against the door, he slid to the floor, sobbing.
"Too hard. This is too hard."
"I hate you,"
he heard Roan whisper through the door. At some point Markin finally drifted to sleep, but only a few hours passed before something awoke him. A feeling like the one he'd had in the markets. A pit in his stomach, filled with icy dread.
"They told someone," he thought. "I've been backstabbed by a couple of children."
But when he peeked outside, there was no crowd gathered, no commotion. In fact, everything was utterly still and silent. He frowned and ducked back inside.
Check on Roan, that was the first thing. He had to make certain the boy kept up his strength, continuing to eat. He mounted the steps, each feeling like an individual mountain to climb. After what seemed an eternity, he made it to the top and quietly pushed open the door. His heart skipped a beat, and then began pounding twice as fast. The bed was empty, the boy's things gone.
"By the gods, no!"
Markin thought, as he rushed down the steps and back outside, scanning the streets for movement. Nothing. Nothing. The boy was gone. 4 years later. He never stopped searching for Roan. Though it made sense that the boy would leave Calypso, hiding somewhere else, Markin had a feeling he hadn't. And so, day by day, he searched the city, one block at a time, asking questions, paying far too much coin for information that usually turned out to be false or old, following leads that always seemed to come to a dead end. He was old and tired and frustrated, but still he searched, because of the promise he'd made to Cecilia. The good news was that if he couldn't find Roan, it was unlikely anyone else had discovered his presence either. Apparently the boy... "He's 14 now," Markin reminded himself. "Almost a man grown." Was exceptionally adept at hiding and surviving. And no information about a Tatuya-bearing Westerner had surfaced in the city gossip circles, so that was something. The children he'd paid the 6 dragons to had disappeared, along with their families. No one seemed to know where they'd gone, though some speculated they'd gone further south to live with relatives. Now it was dark, the brazen southern sun long having sunk beneath the burnt horizon. "One more street," Markin thought, choosing a narrow alley known as a resting place for many of the street dwellers. He tiptoed along, earning grunts and muttered curses as he peeked under threadbare blankets and inside tattered canvas tents. He reached the end of the alley, where a sandstone wall blocked further progress. He sighed. Another lost day. Another failure. Another broken promise. He tried not to dwell on it. The hot sun would rise again on the morrow. Shadows fell over him, long and narrow like spears. He whirled around, but was too slow, a hammer crashing into the side of his head, sending stars spinning and flashing across his vision. Still, his sheer size allowed him to maintain his balance as he clutched his skull. The next attack came a moment later, but this time he managed to duck, flipping the foe over his back. The man landed with a thud and a grunt. Markin had the presence of mind to draw his leather knife, the very same blade he'd once threatened those children with, what seemed like an eternity ago. But Markin was no fighter, and the next attacker easily disarmed him, turning his own knife against him. Markin was weary, not just from the fight, but from life, from his endless search for Roan, from the weight of Cecilia's death, from the sheer effort of trying to keep his promise to her. "Here," he said, rummaging through the pockets of his cloak and tossing out their contents. Dozens of silver, bronze, and copper dragons tinkled to the ground, rolling and spinning. "Take everything I have." That's when he realized the thieves' faces were uncovered by scarf or mask. Though it was dark, he could identify all 3 of them to the Shiva, the city peacekeeper, in a pinch. He nodded, resignation setting in. This was the end. Roan was on his own now. He had been for a while.
"Protect yourself, son," he whispered. "Live the life you were meant to live."
He fell to his knees and stopped fighting.
Postlude 4. Sobria Loren. The Western Kingdom, circa 510. Sobria Loren, though a princess by birth, was never destined to be a queen. Her eldest living brother, Gil Loren, was born 12 years earlier, and, by rights, was heir to their father's crown. She'd once had another brother, Ty, born far earlier than both of them, but he died tragically before Sobria had appeared, as if by magic, in her mother's 50-year-old womb. But now everything had changed. The Hundred Years' War had crept its way into the Bay of Bounty, the largest trade port in the Four Kingdoms, and now the Crimeans were threatening to withdraw all merchant vessels if a treaty wasn't established between the west and north. And that meant trouble for the princess, who'd suddenly gone from beloved daughter to royal bargaining chip. Sabria slammed a fist into her red silk pillow, hating the tears that sprung from the corners of her eyes.
"Why does it have to be me?"
she asked herself for the hundredth time. She stood and stared at her reflection in the mirror, and the answer to her question stared back at her. Her 18-year-old eyes were so bright and blue they seemed to contain the sun-sparkled surface of the ocean. Her hair was so shiny it was as if it had been spun from golden silk. Her features were soft and delicate. She was the prettiest of her female cousins, and thus she'd been chosen. Her arranged marriage to Prince Wulfric Geric was to take place in less than a fortnight. She'd never met him, and knew only that he was 10 years older and first in line for the Northern Throne, which would make her Queen of the North one day. The Ice Queen, she would be called. Sabria had always loved her beauty, spending mornings in front of the mirror while her maidens combed and braided her hair. But her father relentlessly cautioned her against vanity. Perhaps he was punishing her for it now. Perhaps Wrath was reaching down from the seventh heaven and plucking her up like a grape, only to drop her in the frozen snow of the north. She hated her beauty now. Wished she'd been born with a crooked nose or crossed eyes or some other imperfection to make her less desirable.
"Please," she pleaded to the angry god of the Western Kingdom. "I'll never look at myself again. I swear it."
To demonstrate the truth of her promise, she flung her satin sheets from her bed and draped them over her mirror.
"There, it is done," she thought. "Surely Wrath will forgive me. Surely Wrath will answer my prayer and save me from my fate."
She flinched at a sturdy knock on her door.
Could it be?
Had Wrath heard her pleas and responded so quickly?
"Come in,"
she said, trying to keep the tremble from her voice. The door eased open and her father appeared, his short beard full of both salt and pepper these days.
"My daughter," he said,
his eyes soft and kind, his voice full of sorrow and regret. Sabria's heart melted in a puddle on the floor. Why did her father have to be so good all the time? It only made it harder for her to understand why he was punishing her. His eyes roved across the room, to the unmade bed, to the covered mirror, and finally back to her tear-streaked cheeks.
"Sabria, the time has come—"
"No,"
Sabria said, pleading. She fell to her knees, her hands clenched together in supplication, to him, to Wrath.
"I'm sorry,"
he said, and it only made things harder that she could tell he meant it.
"We have no choice. Your marriage to the Northern Prince will solidify our alliance. For the first time in almost 100 years, we could have a sliver of peace with the North. Trade with the Crimeans will resume. Night's End will prosper. We all have a role to play, Sabria, and this is yours."
How does he do that?
Sabria wondered. King Loren could make her feel guilty, even when sending her to the last place in the Four Kingdoms she'd ever want to go. She fought back tears, unthreaded her hands, stood, lifted her chin, playing the role of the proud, courageous princess. She nodded, afraid to speak the truth in her heart.
"I will be ready shortly," she said,
forcing the words between locked teeth.
"You are the best of us,"
her father said, kissing her on both cheeks before departing. When the door closed, Sabria's legs lost all strength, and she slumped to the floor once more. Her prayer was too late, her fate sealed. Then she spotted it, a sliver of silver peeking out from beneath the shadow of her bed. A knife. It wasn't particularly sharp, nor particularly long. The blade was primarily used by her chambermaid to repair clothing. She must have dropped it, lost it beneath the bedskirt, long forgotten. On hands and knees, Sabria crawled across the floor. Her hand shot out and she seized the knife's handle between trembling fingers. She could do it so easily. Bring the blade up, rake it across her face, anywhere would do.
She could even make it look like an accident, like she'd tripped and fallen and sliced her face on a sharp corner of her dressing table. Her beauty marred, her face the home to a long, bright scar, no lord or prince of the North would want her.